Welcome to 30 Minutes on 91.3 KXCI Tucson. I'm Amanda Schager. Today on 30 Minutes, we'll continue with remarks from Amy Goodman's talk at the Leo Rich Theater. On April 28, 2016, Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman returned to Tucson for a talk and book signing. Goodman's talk was a benefit for KXCI Community Radio. During this 2016 election season, Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman is on a 100-city speaking tour to mark the 20th anniversary of the Daily Independent Global TV Radio News Hour with a new book titled Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America by Amy Goodman with David Goodman and Dennis Moynihan. In 1996, acclaimed independent journalist and best-selling author Amy Goodman began hosting a show on Pacifica Radio called Democracy Now! To cover the 1996 election. KXCI first began broadcasting Democracy Now! In October 1998. Democracy Now! Currently airs weekdays at noon. This is part four of a four-part series.
So now, 2011, Tunisian Revolution sparks the Egyptian Revolution, astounding, historic. They, too, throw out their despot. Where the Egyptian Revolution has gone now is another story. It's frightening. It has taken a very twisted, painful turn. It's an unfinished revolution. But I think the Arab Spring also inspired Wisconsin. You remember what happened in Wisconsin in the winter of 2011? I mean, they'd never seen anything like this. 150,000 people march in the Capitol, occupy the Capitol building, because the governor, who was just newly elected, Scott Walker, decided he would go after the public unions, bust them, the teachers and the nurses' unions. He assured the police and the firefighters he wasn't going after them. Walker's problem was that the firefighters and the police were married to the teachers and the nurses. And they understood the philosophy, you know, first they go after them, and if no one speaks up for them, then they'll come after you, and there will be no one left to speak up for you. So everyone was there. I mean, Governor Walker united people across the political spectrum against him. And so in the Capitol building, I mean, when we got there to broadcast from this place where they were all, you know, lined up in sleeping bags, sleeping, they would not leave the Capitol building. I mean, I saw scenes I'd never seen because I come from New York. So you had in front of the governor's office, you know, kids with long dreads, they're drumming on anything they can find, and the police were rocking out next to them. No, that doesn't happen in New York. I saw some of the biggest guys I'd ever seen, the Oshkosh prison guards. And I said to them, well, who did you vote for? And they said, well, Governor Walker, of course. And I said, so what are you doing here? And they said, protesting Governor Walker, of course. Outside, this 150,000 people in the absolute freezing cold, older gentleman, white hair, glasses, holding up a placard he'd written that said, IRS auditors against Walker. And I said, are you a Republican or a Democrat? He said, a Republican. And I said, but isn't Governor Walker a Republican? He said, yeah, but he didn't tell us he was going to do this. It was historic. And, you know, Wisconsin's a very interesting place. It's the home of the John Birch Society, that racist, segregationist, anti-civil rights, anti-king organization that was co-founded by Fred Koch, the father of the oil barons, Charles and David Koch. But also, it's the home of AFSCME, found in 1932, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And I looked across the Capitol grounds and saw the Wisconsin State Labor History Museum. And if you ever think these movements don't matter, you know, like, okay, all these people rose up, the governor was reelected. I mean, he did run for president, had to pull out pretty quickly, and I think it had something to do with this level of protest and ferment in his own state. If you think, but it didn't really amount to a hill of beans, I think you should think again. You know, movements take all sorts of turns. I mean, go back to 1968, April 4th, the day Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. What was he doing there? He was simply going to stand with sanitation workers who were trying to form a local of AFSCME. Yes, what you do matters. And go back a year to the day before he was gunned down at the Lorraine Motel, to New York, Riverside Church, when thousands packed in to hear Dr. King, who decided to speak out against the war in Vietnam. Even his inner circle said to him, Martin, don't do this. You've got the most powerful person on earth wrapped around your finger, the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson. You got him to sign the Voting Rights Act. You got him to sign the Civil Rights Act. This is not your war. You will alienate and damage your cause. And he said no. He stood in this church and spoke before thousands of people, taking on militarism, racism, materialism. And he said, my country, the United States, is the greatest purveyor of violence on earth. He was slammed by the corporate press. I have the Life magazine of the time, Time magazine, Washington Post. They said his speech read like a script from Radio Hanoi. They said he had done a disservice to his cause, his country, and his people. And so he just doubled down. And he spoke ever more loudly and frequently against the war, linking it to the war at home. Movements matter. And now I'm going to jump forward to the end of summer 2011, when thousands of people surrounded the White House, ring around the Rose Garden, against the Keystone XL pipeline. You know, who got arrested? 1,200 people, like Naomi Klein, who wrote This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, like Bill McKibben, who founded 350.org, and 1,200 other people. And then move forward 3 weeks, Occupy Wall Street, right? September 17th, 2011, thousands stream into Zuccotti Park. And the media did not cover them. The vanishing, once again, for about a week. Just didn't. I mean, we're in the media metropolis of the world, New York City. Didn't mention them. And then it was just ridiculous. I mean, they'd set up this encampment. You have to say something. And so they mocked them. I remember Erin Burnett was just starting her show on CNN called Out Front. And I think one of her first pieces was, seriously? And that's how they all dealt with it. They said, what do these people want? I mean, look at them. They have all these signs. They're, you know, you ask any of them a question and they are representing a different issue. They said they're against the death penalty. They're against war. They're against inequality. They're against racial injustice. They're, you know, against fossil fuel dependence and concerned about climate change. And I thought, oh, my God, they are listening, because that's true. All of those things. They saw that as their weakness. I saw that as their strength. They saw this all, like Dr. King, as a seamless web. Oh, and then they would say they can't even figure out who to represent them, right? Who are their leaders? Well, they are a leaderful movement, not a leaderless movement. And that, too, was its power. Now, among the placards that people held was the one that said, I am Troy Davis. And too much doubt. How many of you know who Troy Davis was? So just to tell that story, a lot of you raised your hand, but a lot of you didn't. Democracy Now, 4 days later, September 21st, 2011, raced down to Jackson, Georgia. I was there with our senior producer, Mike Burke, who is preparing tomorrow's show right here in Tucson. Also with Hani Massoud, our videographer, who leaps tall buildings in a single bound. And Renee Feltz, who comes from the Klan-targeted KPFT in Houston, built its newsroom, now works on issues of immigrants' rights and particularly criminal justice. What a team to have at your side when covering an issue like this. We raced down to Jackson, Georgia, where the death row prison in Georgia is. Because on September 21st, 2011, Troy Anthony Davis was scheduled to die. We were reporting live from the grounds outside Georgia's death row in the town of Jackson, awaiting news about whether the U.S. Supreme Court would spare his life. I Am Troy Davis had become a rallying cry of a growing international movement to stop his execution that included not only traditional anti-death penalty activists, but prison wardens, a former U.S. president, and the Pope, all calling for saving Troy Anthony Davis's life. This is the story of a struggle against death that refuses to die. Now, before I finish telling you the story of this day, I have to commend independent media for exposing the death drugs. Like Hospira, the last U.S.-based company to make sodium thiopental, one of the three drugs used in the lethal cocktail administered in most executions in this country, It quit making the controlled drug, creating a national shortage. States began scrambling to keep their death chambers well-stocked. When California borrowed a similar drug from Arizona, its Undersecretary of Corrections and Rehabilitation, Scott Kernan, wrote in an email, "You guys in Arizona are lifesavers." An expose by Katie Fretland in the Colorado Independent reported that Assistant Oklahoma Attorney General Seth Branham joked in an email with a Texas colleague in 2011 that he might be able to help Texas get the drugs in exchange for 50-yard line tickets for a top college football game between the University of Oklahoma and the University of Texas. Branham went on to propose in an email that Oklahoma officials, whom he dubbed Team Pentobarbital, be rewarded with, quote, an on-field presentation of a commemorative plaque at halftime recognizing Oklahoma's ongoing contributions to propping up the Texas system of capital punishment. So now let's go back to Troy Anthony Davis. He grew up in Savannah with his sisters, his brother, and his mother and father. His father, a veteran of the Korean War. On the night of August 18, 1989, 18-year-old Troy, who was African-American, went to Charlie Brown's pool hall with a friend. In a parking lot outside, Red Coles, a neighborhood tough, was arguing loudly with a homeless man named Larry Young. Several witnesses said that Red Coles pistol-whipped Young. Pool hall patrons came outside to see what was going on. Troy Anthony Davis tried to intervene in the fight, but fled when Coles threatened him with a gun. At a quarter after one in the morning, Mark McPhail, a white off-duty Savannah police officer who was working as a security guard at a Greyhound bus station next door, came outside to break up the fight. Gunshots pierced the summer night. Moments later, McPhail lay dying with a bullet wound to the head and another to the heart. He never drew his gun. Mark McPhail was a hero cop. He tried to save a homeless man. The question was, who killed him? Red Coles immediately went to the police station with a lawyer and pointed the finger at Troy Davis. To the shock of many, Troy then was in Atlanta 4 hours away. His family saw his name plastered everywhere on TV and talked about in radio. And his older sister, Martina, a heroine, called him up and said, "Troy, you've got to come back. They are saying you are the one who killed Officer McPhail." Martina Correa, she was a Persian Gulf Army nurse. She came back to this country because she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And, you know, not only was she fighting to save her own life, her face adorned all the mammogram vans of Savannah to convince black women and poor women to get mammograms. She was feted as a leading light in Washington with Nancy Pelosi. But she not only was fighting for her own life, she would soon be fighting for her brother's life. She raced and got him in Atlanta. They came back, and immediately this 18-year-old boy, this 18-year-old teenager, Troy, turned himself in to the Chatham County Sheriff's Office. The teen thought it was a case of mistaken identity and that he would simply clear up the confusion. Instead, he was immediately charged with murder, held for 2 years until he was 20, and then he was tried. A jury deliberated for 2 hours, and in August 1991, Troy Davis, age 20, was sentenced to die. He'd spend the next 20 years of his life on death row. And then during that time, 7 of the 9 non-police witnesses in the case recanted, saying the police had pressured them to point the finger at Troy Davis.
You are listening to remarks from Amy Goodman's Tucson stop of Democracy Now!'s 100 Cities Speaking Tour in conjunction with the 20th anniversary of the program and their new book titled Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America.
So let me go to this day, to the day we flew down, the day for the fourth time he was slated to die. 3 death warrants had been vacated in the past 20 years. He came close to dying several of these times within hours of death. We didn't know what would happen, but we knew he had to broadcast. And so we hired a satellite truck, like the other big boys there, the other networks, because we knew we had to broadcast right there on the prison grounds. If we could have broadcast from the execution chamber, we would have. I really do think, if you see the images, Americans need to know what's done in their name, and I think people would make a very different decision about what our domestic policy should be around issues of the death penalty. Most people don't realize how alone we are in the industrialized world when it comes to state killing. But we couldn't broadcast from there, but we could broadcast from the prison grounds, just to give you a little lesson in how the media works. So we go to the prison grounds, and all the satellite trucks are lined up on the periphery, and we can't figure out why, but the prison guards tell us that you have to stay far away from the protest pen. They had erected a pen for 150 protesters. That would be the limit on the ground. So it was people like Martina, who was there, Troy's older sister. She was now in a wheelchair, would die several weeks later. Human rights leaders like, the head of the NAACP and Amnesty International. Across the street, 1,000 people, and the crowds were growing. The students from Spelman and Morehouse, King's alma mater, were all carrying candles. They had come from Atlanta. There were protests in Iceland and England and Japan and France and Germany. I was annoyed because our satellite truck hadn't shown up. This is the ones that, they're contracted by Fox and by CNN. I didn't know who they were. We hired them from Atlanta. Finally, they came up on the grounds, and they pulled up the satellite truck, and the guys rolled down the window, and they said, "Where do you want the truck?" So I said, "Well, the prison guards are saying we have to go over there, but I mean, we were going to broadcast for hours. I wasn't there to hold the mic so that I could speak, but to go to where the silence was, where the protesters were, which isn't really usually very silent, but it's not where the media shines their spotlight or points their microphones." So this was a real problem, and they said, "Well, where do you want the truck?" And I said, "Well, they're saying over there," and they said, "No, where do you want the truck?" I said, "Over by the protest pen," and they barreled the satellite truck over to the pen. The prison guards come running over, and these guys get out of the satellite truck, who are the videographers and the satellite truck operators, and they were bigger than the Oshkosh prison guards. They took out their cameras, the prison guards backed off, and they handed me the microphone and sort of formed a kind of protective semicircle around me. They said, "Where do you want to broadcast?" I said, "Well, I guess right against the rope so I could reach my mic over and interview everyone." And they said, "Okay, start the show." And so at 6 o'clock, we began the broadcast. We're the only national broadcast in this country to be there uninterrupted for the hours that would follow. And we had the prison press packet. It was pretty thin. One page told us about Troy's schedule that day. They said that he could meet with family till 3, then they had to clear out so he could get a routine physical. A routine physical? They were going to kill him in 4 hours. What difference does it make if he has atherosclerosis? Are they kidding? Well, what had happened a while before is that a Texas prisoner had attempted suicide on death row. They raced him to the hospital. They got him better, and then they executed him. So the next page talked about what Troy would have for dinner. He had refused any kind of special meal, that a person on death row is offered right before he's killed. He could have anything he wants to eat. He had said no. So they made a big deal of what exactly he would be offered, the standard fare. They reported it in detail in this press packet. They said Troy Davis would be offered, quote, grilled cheeseburgers, oven brown potatoes, baked beans, coleslaw cookies, and a grape beverage. The next page had 4 lines. That's it. That page listed the lethal cocktail that would follow: pentobarbital, pancuronium bromide, potassium chloride, and Ativan, a sedative. That's what it said in parentheses, a sedative. The pentobarbital anesthetizes, the pancuronium bromide paralyzes, and the potassium chloride stops the heart. Davis refused the sedative and his last meal. By 7 p.m., the U.S. Supreme Court was reportedly reviewing Davis's plea for a stay. The case was referred to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who hailed from Pinpoint, Georgia, which was a community founded by freed slaves that's near Savannah, where Davis had lived. Needless to say, the Supreme Court denied the plea. Davis's execution began at 10:53 p.m. A prison spokesperson delivered the news to the reporters outside. Time of death, 11:08 p.m. The eyewitnesses to the execution stepped out. According to an Associated Press reporter who was there, these were Troy Davis's final words as he was strapped down on the gurney, Christ-like cross, arms strapped, legs strapped, needle in the arm. At that point, they pull the curtain back, exposing a window, and the audience can watch. It's made up of the murder victim's family, the person that the prisoner chooses to come if the prison will allow it, and the reporters. The eyewitnesses to the execution stepped out. And this is what the Associated Press reporter said were Troy's final words. He said, Troy said, I'd like to address the McPhail family. Let you know, I'm not the one who killed your son, your father, your brother. I'm innocent. The incident that happened that night was not my fault. I did not have a gun. All I can ask is that you look deeper into this case so that you really can finally see the truth. He said, I ask my family and friends to continue to fight the fight. And then he looked at his executioners and said, for those about to take my life, God have mercy on your souls, and may God bless your souls. The state of Georgia took Davis's body to Atlanta for an autopsy, charging his family for the transportation. On Troy Davis's death certificate, the cause of death is listed simply as homicide. As I stood on the grounds of the prison just after Troy Davis was executed, the Georgia Department of Corrections threatened to pull the plug on our broadcast. The show was over. I was reminded of what Mahatma Gandhi reportedly answered when asked what he thought of Western civilization. He said, I think it would be a good idea. As I come to the end of the year, in December of 2011, that was the UN Climate Summit in Durban, South Africa. We go to all of them. You know, Copenhagen we started, and then we went to Cancun and to Cochabamba, the People's Summit in Bolivia, then to Durban, then to Doha the following year, then to Poland, then to Peru, and then to Paris. Given what happens inside these summits, you might ask, why did we waste the fuel? But it's not so much what happens inside. It's the thousands of people who come from the most impacted countries on earth, pleading desperately for the industrialized world, particularly the historically greatest greenhouse gas emitter, the United States, and also China, to change our ways. They come from the Maldives, a 15-year-old boy saying, please, my country will soon be submerged. They come from sub-Saharan Africa, talking about the desertification of a continent. You know, we suffer severe climate change in this country, too. These disparate weather conditions that you can't put together as related. They seem so different. You know, the freezing cold weather of the Northeast, the 100-year flood in Colorado, yet the Dust Bowl conditions of the Midwest, the fires of California. It's up to the meteorologists. They shouldn't be able to get a license on television or radio unless they not only flash the word severe weather and extreme weather, but climate change, global warming. It's not just about tuning in to figure out what to wear that day. It's about what we can do about it, and we must do it as a country, as a nation, as a community to save this planet. Now, in the rest of the world, it's not as if they don't have debates around climate change. They do, about what to do about it. You know, what's the best strategy to deal? In this country, we continue to debate whether or not human beings have anything to do with climate change. The science is settled. It's as if every time we talked about the planet Earth, we brought someone on from the Flat Earth Society for balance. Now, every once in a while, something extraordinary happens at these climate summits. Well, just to talk to the people on the outside is amazing. They're not invited in. They are uncredentialed, but they come anyway. And so we're always out there interviewing the uninvited guests. But in South Africa, in the end of 2011, young people at the end of the conference were invited in to address their elders. Their spokesperson, Angelia Padere, who is a student at College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine, where you get a degree in human ecology. I'll be speaking there in a few weeks. And this is part of what Angelia said. She looked out on the vista of faces, the diplomats, the delegates, the scientists, the world leaders, and said, I speak for more than half the world's population. We are the silent majority. You've given us a seat in this hall, but our interests are not on the table. What does it take to get a stake in this game? Lobbyists, corporate influence, money? You've been negotiating all of my life. You failed to meet pledges, you've missed targets, you've broken promises, but you've heard this all before. We're in Africa, home to communities on the front line of climate change. The science tells us we have 5 years maximum. You're saying, give us 10. The starkest betrayal of your generation's responsibility to ours is that you call this ambition. Where is the courage in these rooms? Now is not the time for incremental action. In the long run, these will be seen as the defining moments of an era in which narrow self-interest prevailed over science, reason, and common compassion. There is real ambition in this room, but it's been dismissed as radical, deemed not politically possible. Stand with Africa. Long-term thinking is not radical. What's radical is to completely alter the planet's climate, to betray the future of my generation, to condemn millions to death by climate change. What's radical is to write off the fact that change is within our reach. 2011 was the year in which the silent majority found their voice, the year when the bottom shook the top. 2011 was the year when the radical became reality. And then she quoted Nelson Mandela, who said, "It always seems impossible until it's done." She ended by looking out on the gathering, this world body, and said, "So distinguished delegates and governments around the world, governments of the developed world, deep cuts now. Get it done." We broadcast every day from these UN climate summits, our full broadcast every day. Nobody else did this, bringing out voices like Anjali Appadure so you could hear her full speech. You know, we have a job to do. There's a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power. My brother and I wrote a book called Static. The reason we called it that is in this high-tech digital age with high-def television and digital radio, still all we get is static, that veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality, when what we need is the media to give us the dictionary definition of static: criticism, opposition, unwanted interference, a media that covers power, not covers for power, a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state, and a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. And so I will end where I began, back in World War II. Here I'll end in Germany, Nazi Germany, with a brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl, who together with their professor and other students — Hans and Sophie weren't Jewish, they were German Christians — but they thought, what can we do in the face of the Nazi atrocity? And so with other students and their professor and some workers, they formed the White Rose Collective. And they decided they would try to put out a series of pamphlets so the Germans would never be able to say, "We didn't know." They put out this series of 6 pamphlets. On one of them were written the words, "We will not be silent." And they distributed these everywhere. Oh, in the middle of the night, under cover of darkness, in alleyways and marketplaces, they dropped them in schoolyards. Hans and Sophie were captured along with their professor by the Gestapo. They were charged, they were tried, they were convicted, and they were beheaded. But that philosophy, that motto, should be the Hippocratic Oath of the media today, should be the Hippocratic Oath of us all today. We will not be silent. Democracy Now!
We'll have to leave it there. You've been listening to remarks made by Amy Goodman at the Tucson stop of Democracy Now!'s 100 City Speaking Tour, in conjunction with the 20th anniversary of the program and their new book titled Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America. Thanks for listening to 30 Minutes on 91.3 KXCI Tucson. This has been part 4 of a 4-part series. Amy Goodman's entire talk can be found on the 30 Minutes program page at kxci.org.